Tyson.
Well, thank you very much as we continue with our talk shows here on WBAM. We're going to take some memories out of that scalp of yours today, my friend. We have the former owner of Ann Arbor Implement, for you newer people around, Paul Lohr, with us today. Paul is well known as a businessman in downtown Ann Arbor, as a pilot before World War II, and he has a lot of memories that we'll talk about today. Paul, welcome.
Hello, Ted. Nice to see you.
Madeline, are you listening?
I'm sure she is. She says she would be. She's home today.
I think someone called the other day after you were on the phone and said she had a birthday.
Oh, yes. When I talked to you on the phone, I made a mistake not to mention that was her birthday that day. She was 82 on the day I last talked to you on Wham.
Happy birthday, Madeline.
I apologize to her for that.
And your boy's there, too? Say hello to him.
No, the boy is at home in Ann Arbor. That's the youngest boy, in electronics. The other one's on Ellsworth Road, and the daughter's out by the Ann Arbor Airport.
Do you tell me you were born near the airport?
Yeah, on Lower Road, you know, down below Ellsworth Road on the big Lower House. I was born and raised there in 1920. And for those listeners that would like to know, the airport of Ann Arbor was dedicated in 1928. So it's that old. So a lot of people don't know that. And I learned to fly there in 1940. That's a period of time.
You know, as kids on Dewey Street, which is off State Road, State Street, we used to walk out to the airport. It was all country then after.
Sure was.
Just to sit there and watch those airplanes.
That's fun. Even if you, the days you aren't flying, it's just a lot of enjoyment to watch small airplanes. But I spent a lot of time in small airplanes and the big ones.
Did you participate in any of the air shows they had out there?
Yes, I put on quite a few air shows in the Stearman, the big biplane that I used in the training command. I bought one right after the war in 1946 when I got out of the Air Force and put on mild air shows. Not low level, I wasn't low level, but good air shows around the state, up and down the state, Bay City, Monroe, and Jackson, and like that. And also, like I told you, I flew for Wham, Don Bailey, with his Enterprise. Yeah, he sure told you about that. And also Coca-Cola, those type of things, as you put on the show. These are interesting to people that didn't do that kind of flying. Inverted flying, loops, rolls, and so on.
Listen, you learned to fly in 1940.
Yes.
And then did you enlist in the Air Force when the war came along?
No, it was sort of an enlistment because I was a pilot with a lot of time built up. By the way, I worked at King Sealy and on the night shift, and I went to Cleary College, and I flew because I had the money from my job. Flew all I could for the next about 2.5 years. Built up a lot of time, and that qualified me for being a civilian flight instructor for the Army Air Force in Americus, Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, that flight school, that huge flight school you taught at, what was the name of that?
Sutterfield, Americus, Georgia. I told you before the program that Charles Lindbergh, he did his first flying there, and they also bought his first Jenny. That's a big old biplane after World War I. They were a surplus airplane, so there are statues there at the airport. It was the biggest trainer that field was for World War I, and also a very big one in World War II. But there were a lot of these fields around called basic, and advanced trainers.
You trained a lot of young men?
For over a year and a half, every 2 months, we got five beautiful young men from around the United States, from coast to coast. The finest young men you ever want to find. I happened to be their age at that time because I got into the program early as a pilot. And pilots weren't as plentiful as they are after the war or today.
And one of those young men was my cousin Jack Weeks.
Yes, he's a very fine pilot, well-trained, and he had a real quality person.
And What do you fly, a P-38 on VE?
P-47. Yeah, 7,000 pounds, 2,000 horsepower is what he flew.
And I had shot down in that,
It's so saddening to me to know how many of my boys actually made it through the service. I mean, I knew them well, worked with them, got along good with them, and they went into the service, and as the 8th Air Force lost like over around 50,000 men, pilots and crews. And it's so sad that some of my boys just had to be in there, but it's all gone beyond us now, but past us. But it's a lot of memories I think about, a great deal.
I bet you do. Now, you were also on regular trips from England to the mainland and back and forth, and you flew over in India.
Well, the type of flying you did out of Love Field, Dallas, when I was in the Air Transport Command, that's what it was called. By the way, in that squadron was Gene Autry. He was in my squadron, 91st Squadron in Dallas. I got to talk to him many days, just general discussion, a very fine man. But we flew out of there. The first flight, I'll tell you, was San Francisco to New York, into Florida and back to Texas, just flying personnel from the one coast to the other, taking them from the Pacific. These were shell shock patients. And it was that was my first flight. You flew co-pilot at that time. And then I flew B-24s, B-17s as co-pilot. My first trip to deliver a new airplane was to India. Now, that's one long haul at 170 miles an hour. And today's travel is 600 miles an hour. So we were in the horse and buggy age when you look back.
There's your B-24.
Oh, yes. Well, Laurent, I flew four engines of that size. I flew co-pilot on them, but it was good training. A lot of B-17 co-pilot time I had, because after the war, we brought one home from England all the way through Brazil on up into Florida.
What did they do with all the airplanes?
They went to Arizona, and primarily they were cut up most of them were cut for scrap. You know, the engines were salvaged and so on. I was out there and saw some of it. It's just certain ones were sold. I'll tell you, Ted, my introduction to twin engine in the school when I went into the regular Air Force was the AT-9. It was a twin engine trainer, and it was such a hot airplane, like 110 over the fence to make a landing, that they didn't save any of them except in the museum. There's one in Dayton, and that's about it. But give you some idea how the progress of training went.
You'd have thought some companies would have picked them up.
Companies did pick up the twin engines and convert them to their purpose, into commercial their companies' businesses, you know. But other than that, than what the plane I bought after World War II, 46, was a Stearman. They were surplus, and they were safe to fly. I had it for 8 years, and then I bought three other ones after that.
You continued to fly almost until recently.
Yeah, right up until two, three months ago, I decided my home care for my wife, Madeline, was more important than pursuing aviation in the future. When you're crowding 84, somewhere along the line, you got to hang that up and live on memories.
Did you hate to do that? I mean, flying was your life for 50 years.
Even when I was in business, with the Ann Arbor Implement for 50 years, I flew on weekends, and they didn't put in a lot of hours, but it was a good quality time. We used to say, finally, later on, like the plane that I told you I had for sale now, we used to go for $50 hamburgers. We'd go to Marshall, Michigan, or Jackson, or Monroe, or places like that. Just on a morning flight, you know. They never put up a lot of hours, but it was good flying. Maybe a few rolls and loops on the way, and just kept my hand in. But we, compared to what the boys are flying today, and I saw last night on the TV, I mean, they're so advanced that it really put us in the horse and buggy age at the time we were flying in the 40s. But it was interesting, and we were modern then.
Well, I still like to watch those series on the Black Sheep. of, of World War II down in the islands. The Black Sheep Squadron and those planes, you know, may be old today, but they sure didn't look it.
They were Corsairs. The planes that were flying in. I don't know that any of my students ever flew Corsairs, but that was a great squadron, and I watched all the movies and knew the specs on it. And I forget his name now, the leader over at Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Got to talk to him a little bit. He used to show up there and have a booth there and sell books because he had so much time in the Corsairs with his squadron. It was an interesting time of life. But there were so many lives lost, it takes all the fun out of flying.
Did you ever meet anybody from the Flying Tigers?
I never did. I flew D. Barnard, I know, but he flew the P-40s up in Alaska, but that was the same plane that the Flying Tigers flew.
Well, you remember when Muehlig had the chapel.
Yes.
And Bob Rogers worked there.
Yes.
Well, Bob Rogers married the granddaughter of Claire Chennault.
I declare.
He lives in the South now, so he's become somewhat of a historian of the Flying Tigers, and he's always sending me notices or something like that. There are only a couple left, but...
I might relate something interesting. Down in the training command, a couple accidents that happened that, to your listeners, there were accidents happening all the time with the tramp boys when they were flying solo. And one of them was this boy was flying. This time he was flying with the instructor. And the instructor said to him, "You're gaining altitude all the time." He was up from 800 to 1,000 feet. The instructor popped a stick forward, and the instructor looked back. There was a mirror up in front for us to look at, and the student wasn't there. This is at a low, low altitude. And the instructor circled around, and he couldn't find the student anyplace. He was sure he'd gone in and gone. You come back to the field, reported it, the ambulance and emergency crews went out to look for the body. And it turned out that here was a student walking up the country road in Georgia with a chute under his arm. Now, that is a fact, and it was just interesting that he survived that unusual accident. It all because he didn't have his seat belt fastened.
Exactly.
Like you should have your seat belt fastened today in a car, but people won't believe you.
Uh-huh. And listen, now how long did you serve?
4 years.
4 years.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention another accident down there that was not fatal. A boy took off and he ground looped and turned 180 degrees on takeoff and just became airborne 180 degrees from where he started and crashed into a box factory and survived. Demolished the airplane but walked away from it. We were glad for cases like that.
You had a question for Paul?
Yes, Ted. It's Harriet.
Who's this?
Harriet Birch, I guess.
Oh.
Hi to both of you guys. I couldn't resist listening. Paul, you're right there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, that's good. I didn't know it was going to be today, so this is great. I'm glad that you came to do this, and I'm sure the public will be interested in what you're talking about.
I certainly hope so. I hope I explained it properly.
Okay, and
a lot
Ted,
of memories.
Ted, I'm at Weber's for our 40 class lunch today, and we'll be missing you.
Yeah, well, I hope to be there. I have an appointment at 12:15 with my surgeon.
Oh, boy, I understand completely. But we'll think about you, okay?
All righty.
And lots of good wishes.
Thank you.
For improved health, okay?
All right.
Talk to you all later. Bye-bye.
Our class of 1940.
Yeah, she calls my wife. She calls Madeline about it every 2 or 3 days just to cheer her up and talk to her.
Good. She's good.
She's a very kind person.
How many years were you at Ann Arbor Implement?
What's that?
How many years did you own Ann Arbor Implement?
50 years. The story was, I come back from the war. Pilots were very plentiful. I mean, very plentiful. And so getting into that occupation, I just went with my father was looking for me to go in the business. I was with him for 8 years, and my father passed away, a wonderful man. So then it was left to me to be the only boy at that time. I had sort of learned the business, and I run it for another 42 years. And Madeline was with me 30 years. At Ann Arbor Implement. A lot of memories there in one spot.
Well, Ann Arbor Implement was at what location, the first location?
The first location was on Ashley in my father's time in 1925, but then it went down to First Street, 210 South First Street, which is now three nightclubs and with a condo on the third floor.
Every time I go by that, I think of you. But tell me, when you say he started back in the 20s, what did he start with? What
he was a farmer, and he went to Lansing College. And when he came back to farm with his father on Lower Road, that he decided he wanted to get in the business. So my father gave him some of his small inheritance money, bought a small share in Ann Arbor Implement, and that's how it all started. And then I came along.
What did they sell?
Farm equipment. International McCormick and McCormick Deering farm equipment. And it was a real business. In fact, I was in the implement business when I came back from the war in 46. Mm-hmm. But being the only son, and my father was very grateful to me and gave me the opportunity to learn a business. And by the time he was left us, I was able to carry on. A long time, more than a lot of people.
And you ended up basically with garden and machinery.
Yeah, well, we finally switched over to lawn and garden gradually. That was a good business, along with some pretty good-sized tractors. It was a gradual thing, along with pretty much a full heavy hardware. We had five mechanics in one shop and one in a saw shop, and a couple parts people, and a couple salesmen.
That's a big step.
It was taking care of the personnel, but a good training field.
And you had Madeline in the office.
And she was in the office, and she kept books just like she takes them at home. She takes care of them at home. She's wonderful all the way around. We got 59 years of marriage and 60 coming up next June. So we're very proud of it. 60 years coming up.
In June of 2004.
Right. And a wonderful lady, and always been that way. We're two low-key people and get along just beautiful.
Now, both of you went to Ann Arbor High School.
No, that's something strange. To this day, people think that I went to Ann Arbor High School and I was in their history class. They were sure. But the truth was, I did spend a lot of time over there with friends. I graduated from University High School.
University High School?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That was back in 38. And from there on, met Madeline, I courted her, and she came, by the way, she came down to Dallas, Texas, and we got married there. And that was what happened. Just two or three weeks later, I found myself in India for a month, going across North Africa and through Cairo and like that. Very interesting
after
time.
After you got married?
After, right, just two or three weeks after we got married. I took a few days off. But we were moving on. Orders were coming through there all the time. We were support pilots, you know, moving airplanes just like Gene Autry did in that same squadron. It was a very interesting time. I'd like to tell you about a trip that, during the Battle of the Bulge, they called us together and said, you're going to go over. They got together 100 C-47 aircraft. And we're in the staging area during the Battle of the Bulge. You remember that? Your older audience.
My friend Ben Cope was in that.
And so we went over the northern route, but they put the crew together so fast that in my crew, I was the pilot, and I had a co-pilot, fresh out of cadets, never been in the airplane before. I had another co-pilot in the back, two radio operators, fresh out of cadets, never in the airplane before, and a master sergeant that was off of a B-24. Now, these were crews that were put together, and they sent us up over the northern route. And it was not a good airplane for the northern route at that time of year that we went, because it went up through Goose Bay, Labrador, across the tip of Greenland, and it landed in Iceland, Stornoway, Scotland, and down into Prestwick, Scotland, which turned out to be my base. But that was probably the most interesting flight. A lot of ice, a lot of bad weather, night takeoffs. It was just a good thing I was young and able to handle it.
And no plane trouble?
No plane troubles. By the way, I've got in 63 years of flying, I've yet to damage an airplane. I had one forced landing, Ted, in my life, and that was a Stinson I had. An engine let go, and out on near the airport, I dropped it into a cornfield with no damage. So I've been a very fortunate person. Maybe it's time that I did leave.
Hey, during the war, when you know those warplanes, did you wear a parachute?
We had parachutes on board. We didn't wear them. But there was the kind of airplane we flew, C-47. The only way to get out of those would have been the big cargo door in the back. You know, if you by the time you got your chute on, it would not be it'd be hard to do it. But we did have them on board. On VE Day, we were coming up from London, and a member of the boy, we had flares that were off for colors of the day. We'd shoot outside the airplane in case we were challenged if we were in over France. And the boys, I remember on VE Day, they wanted to shoot them off. And I said, no, I didn't want to take a chance that field day pulled the trigger inside of the airplane. You know, these were big shells like that shot out colors. It was rather interesting to think about that.
Oh, yeah. Paul Lars, well, that's... As we're reminiscing through the years, my friend, we're 29 minutes past the hour of 11 o'clock on WAAM, and we'll be back. Paul Lars with us here as we're reminiscing. Paul, yeah, Howard Barnes, Lowell Thomas, John Vandergook, John Garfield, Richard Carlson. I mean, you had, Bob Hope, you had some famous people in your airplanes.
Well, where I was stationed, Ted, was in Prestwick, Scotland. That was the end spot after they crossed the Atlantic, the first stop they come when they went to Europe. And on Bob Hope, when they hit Prestwick, the CO of the field designated two pilots, myself and another one, to take Bob Hope and Jerry Colonna into London. And so we spent some quality time with them, along with some English personnel. The only plane that flew the military then was either English or American personnel with orders.
Jerry Colonna.
And I had Bob Hope up front flying, and that was a very interesting time talking to him.
What kind
about
of people
a half hour.
Did you find them?
Or what?
How did you find those people? Were they friendly, nice?
They were very friendly. I got to say, Jerry Colonna was the most friendly. He's not as well known as Bob Hope, but Bob Hope was a wonderful man. But he really was. He took over the conversation 100%. He was very glad. I remember going out to the plane. He says, "It's sure great to get out of New York," you know, because he was able to get on tour, and. They put on a show at our field at Prestwick, and then I was lucky enough to be the pilot to take him on his first shot out of there. These other ones, the personnel here, Howard Barnes, Lowell Thomas, the older people will know them as radio commentators and announcers, and they were going over to the time of the Holocaust. So I got to talk to each one of them, and as I showed you, I got their signatures, which is something we collected with the short snorter. I would like to know your audience, if there's anybody out there in the Ann Arbor listening audience or in Ipsy that has a short snorter. They certainly would. I've seen short snorters rolled up in bills this big around, Ted, and this was all rolled up, too, for years and years and years, and finally
he has a big display of the money from all these different countries he was in and friends were in. All these different countries.
As I passed through them, we used to pick up their bills and put them together, starting out with a dollar bill, collecting signatures from your crews, and then we get into the English pound and the shilling, and on. They're all different bills. I got a little of this and a little of that in Brazil, and just so many of them. It's very interesting. It's on my wall all the time at home. But those for years were in the drawer, a better part of 40 years. I did bring something. This is something, a little collection that was in the drawer at home, a collection of for me. It was there for the better part of 40 years. I got them out, and these are the different wings and the battle stars. If you got into an area, you got battle stars. And the type of emblems we used. And then this is instructor program. Your audience can't see this, but I'm showing this to Ted.
It's all in framework. It's beautiful.
But that's, you'll see many military people have these things in their drawer, and I simply put it on a plaque and have it on the wall at home. It reminds me of bygone days.
It sure does.
There's a little history down there. But I was all, some of this here, but after the war, I was in charge of the Civil Air Patrol, so that's what these ranks are here. I was in the Civil Air Patrol before the war, and then I went back, became commander of a search and rescue for the Ann Arbor area. By the way, I read they're trying to start that up again, the Civil Air Patrol for search and rescue. When a plane goes down any place in the state, the small planes go out and put a search pattern on. We did a lot of that.
Now, listen, my gosh, who are you going to leave this to? Whom are you going to leave it to?
I'm sure one of the children would like it to...
It should be on display.
To put it on, well, it's on display at home. But these are the emblems from the uniforms, we finally had, going back to the training command, we finally had uniforms, and this is a cap emblem, and it's an eagle with the wings way up over way over your head, and the boys used to call that the, if you understand, like a 10G pullout. If you made a fast pullout of an airplane, the wings would literally fold up. I mean, it used to be that way in World War I, and these are the wings here. This is Civil Air Patrol wings. I know you in the audience you can't see this, but Ted's looking at it. This is from the 8th Air Force, and I spent time with them called the Air Transport Group out of River Station below Cherbourg. That was an interesting time. We would go from Cherbourg, from that area, into England, and pick up gas. We'd pick up 100 jerry cans. You know what a jerry can is, Ted?
What?
The back of a Jeep. You've seen these gas cans?
Oh, yeah.
We used to haul 100 of those. And we would burn more gas than what we hauled. But we would go into England, and they had workers there that would load up 100 cans. They'd run a rope through them, and we'd go past the channel and take them up to the front when the front was winding down.
You ever hit one of those, they'd explode.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we had some fighter cover during that time. But it was interesting. It's an interesting time. The next day or two, maybe our orders from below Cherbourg would be to haul 2 Jeeps to the front. Brand new Jeeps. They would that's all we could haul. That was a maximum. Not today. Today they haul massive loads. But to do that type of flying, it was never a dull moment if you were a pilot in the left seat.
Listen, that one decoration there looks like a German decoration.
Which one is that? Well, that's just for sure. if during your training, military training, you go to pistol practice, and it's called a sharpshooter emblem, and they simply issued that when you finished the course shooting pistols. You know, we had 45 pistols issued to us, but they were so heavy most of the time you didn't carry them because being a pilot you couldn't have much use for them. But when you went into Europe, everybody got a brand new 45 and plenty of ammunition to carry with you.
Yeah, that's more than they get today.
I think so. But you ever shoot a 45?
No.
It has a tremendous kick. I mean, it's very hard to even in our days of practice, it's very hard to hit a target. But so I got plenty of practice with that. Yeah. They gave it in a short time in training from being a flight instructor into the Air Force. We went from same as a student, a shorter course, but from basic into steermans and then into BTs. Your audience will know what called a multi-vibrator. That was 450 horse. And then I went on into twin engine into the AT-9, which is a hot twin, because I was going to fly twins and fours in the future.
Listen, if you since we lost so many in the going over Europe, you know, I think it was a couple hundred thousand altogether. Could you turn out enough people?
Well, it got to
qualified people.
We had so many schools going in the United States, the primary and basic and advanced prime schools, that we were turning them out at a fast rate. And some of the boys that maybe didn't make it, they used to think there was a washout rate going back, you know, when they were being in training. The truth was that there was not a washout rate, but when they needed pilots, we would give them just minimum amount of time. But when they needed them real bad, they would say, give them all the time you want. And when they didn't need pilots to back up what was going on, then they would say, when in doubt, wash them out. But that never happened in my case. I was able to put all my students through and pass all their check rides. By the way, I became a check pilot before I left America's Georgia. I was rechecking students for progress checks. We were in the air a lot, even at night, flying off of the, out of Georgia with very heavy flying suits. We had no position lights on the field. We had smudge pots and a truck that sat out there with a light on. We'd land in the light. Two traffic patterns went around like this, about five airplanes in each pattern. Very interesting time. Everybody crowding on the final approach to get into that light so you could see the ground.
Did you have many crashes?
I never saw a crash at night. I saw a lot of airplanes as we were going out up on their nose because they'd hit the brakes thinking they saw something, and up they would go, and that would be the end of the flight for the night. But we didn't do a lot of that. But we had position lights, and that's all we had. That's on the wings, and a green light and a red light on the wings, and a white one on the tail. But those planes were built specially for to give the students some idea of what night flying was like, just a preliminary of what they would see in the future, because they went on to become polished pilots.
So then where did they go after they learned to fly and after they got out of this school? Where did the combat pilots...
They simply went to their chosen ones. I had students that would want to pick four engine, like B-17s. In other words, want to pick fighters, like P-51s or P-47s. And some of them got their wish. A lot of them didn't. But the ones that wanted to, they did get into the four engine. And practically all my boys became left seat pilots. In other words, they were the cream of the crop and well trained. And one of my students wrote to me, said, "Well, today I soloed the B-17. And this, I got these letters, a stack of letters that high, Ted. And he says in this letter, he said, "I soloed the B-17. If you call it soloing with nine other men." But I thought that was very interesting.
Where did the P-38 come in?
The P-38 was a twin tails. There was a special training field for that and was used in certain areas of the war. First, it was used for mapping, but then used as a fighter. I'm not very familiar with it, never had an opportunity to fly.
Is that in the Pacific or over in the European war?
It was used in the Pacific, so I wasn't familiar with that. But my students mostly flew the P-47s like Jack Weiss did. Mm-hmm. And I had one student down in New Guinea wrote to me, says he was out on a daily flights looking for Japs, you know, that type of thing, and related his experiences and always looking for a dogfight, you know. This is in the letters I have. It's just today I get them out once in a while and look at them to reminisce and wonder if the boys made it.
They could be made into a book, all those letters.
What's that?
Couldn't it be made into a book?
Yes. Some of them very interesting, but I try to just tell you, Ted, just the most interesting ones I can just think of over the top of my head.
Listen, the P-47, could that match the Jap in speed and in maneuvering?
Well, what they told me, the one in New Guinea, he said, when the Japs saw the P-47s come, they didn't come up to fight. This is in the letter. He says that because the P-47 was predominant in the air at that time. They did have P-51s before that, but the P-47 had the most firepower because it's most, 7,000 pounds and 2,000 horsepower. And he just thought, as a pilot, he just raved about it in his letters.
And I think we had armor that the Japs didn't have.
Yes, sir. The Japanese, at that time, they built their airplanes light. They didn't have armor protection for their pilots. The United States really put a lot of strength into the airplanes for them.
Well, where did the Corsair come in? Did that... was that in the Pacific? Or
that's Pacific. We didn't see any of that in Europe. I said I didn't leave Europe. Everything was my... in the Navy, I didn't know anything about. Was what I was in.
We had the B-17 that you flew and the B-24. What were the fighter planes?
P-51s was the most popular one in Europe. Of course, P-40s early on in the beginning of the war, but they were finally phased out. Like you said, the Flying Tigers had the P-40s. Then, once again, D. Barnard flew those up on patrol in Alaska. But there were so many more. By the way, one of them was early on in the Pacific was the Dauntless Dive Bomber. You might have heard that term, SND. Yeah. And
that was two people in that.
Two people, yes. One of them was a gunner in the back.
Is that what Bush flew?
He flew on similar to that. I mean, a larger than that. Yeah. But that was 1,250 horsepower. That was the biggest fighter that I flew, and I flew it for training purposes down in Dallas. And the kind of, by the way, once you got to a field and they found out from your itinerary you were a flight instructor, sometimes they wanted to keep you as a flight instructor because when at Dallas, I thought I would be there the rest of the war, flying all the airplanes that we have, small airplanes and the Dauntless Dive Bomber, giving orientation rides in that. And most of that flying in the Dauntless was very interesting, you know, with the horsepower and its performance and so on. It was just an interesting time. But there we had BTs, AT-6s, and I'd fly the one and then the other. So I did a lot of instructing time. These were rechecks mostly. These were, when you got to that field, these pilots had possibly flown them before, but you were rechecking them again. But I did get out of there when the Battle of the Bulge come, and I went over to stay.
Now, when you had a fighter plane or a bomber, was that your plane, or did everybody fly it?
Everybody flew it. I'll tell you, really, talk about everybody. In Prestwick, we have probably had the first deluxe C-47 in Europe. And it means a shiny C-47 with airline seats. And it was designated to our field because we had so many dignitaries coming into the field. Well, I got orders one day, another pilot and I, to go to Rome. Now, this is one of the longest hauls I had. And so another pilot and I took the airplane to Rome out of Prestwick, Scotland. That's one long flight, tell your audience, at 170 miles an hour to Rome. And there we picked up three generals and their aides. From there on, we went to Cairo. These generals were on inspection tours for the bases. And once we hit Cairo, we went down to Luxor. That's where our orders were. We went down to Luxor, where the millionaires of the day would spend their vacations on the Nile. And Ted, would you believe it or not, they took a day off, and they went across the Nile, and we were with the generals in the boat and rode up some duckies up into the Valley of the Kings. And we got into King's Tut tomb. And this is all on duty for the generals. And that was one day that they took off, and they said, take care of the pilots, and they sure did. We were treated royally.
Treated like royalty.
We were. We were treated real well, especially on that particular tour. That was a very interesting time. One awful lot of flying, especially to your audience at 170, when they're used to flying airlines at 400 to 500 miles an hour.
Now, that didn't mean you were in the same plane each time.
No. Whatever plane was available on the field, we had a lot of planes. A lot of C-47.
What about a fighter pilot? Did he have the same plane?
As I understand it, yes, they had a plane assigned to him and a crew. And in the fight, that would be my boys. If they were boys, all boys, I mean, they were all real supermen, like Jack Weiss would have been, with a crew. And they're also eager to get in the war. It was just unbelievable. I got a lot of pictures of each crew as it went through, and I worry about him to this day, how many of them were. By the way, I'm in touch with one of them down in Alabama. He calls me very regularly, one of my students. He flew P-47s, and I got one in Las Vegas that calls me and to reminisce, you know. He went on and flew the U-2 and XR-71s, and, you know, I mean, some of these boys just really went on. They were well educated, a lot of college time before they hit me. Interesting time to be a pilot, Ted, for being young and be a pilot and like to fly.
Thousands of hours you put in.
All beyond me.
We're going to be back with Paul Lohr on WAAM. Carr is with us as we're reminiscing through the years on his
63. I've been at it since 1940, so it's coming up on 64. 63 years of flying, yeah. And the lucky thing with my time and type of airplanes and instructing, I've yet to lose an airplane or scratch one. One forced landing in that period, and that goes for military and civilian flying. And that's all different types of airplanes.
You know, I can't think of the guy's name, but he's an old-time pilot in Ann Arbor years ago. His first name was Bruce. He had a lot to do with the University of Michigan. I think he played on the team at one time. And he had a forced landing on Ferry Field once.
Chet, I don't remember that.
Way before your time. But I was told this story.
A lot of things have gone by, and a lot of good memories. The airport is in good hands right now, Ann Arbor Airport, for your public audience. That we have an airport manager that's really doing a great job of upkeep, keeping things orderly, and the government has got the tower. They built some big fence around it to keep the animals out, and also as a security for the Ann Arbor Airport. I want you to know it's well-kept and well-managed, and a lot of acreage, and a lot of that goes to Eli Gallup, who is in charge of the park department.
And they're always trying to take those acreage away from us.
Eli Gallup had the foresight of buying that acreage up. That goes all the way from State Street over to Lower Road. See, that's where I was born, right across the field there. And so it was very, very interesting that he did that. And the fields are rented out for corn and crops right now. But it is city property. And by the way, you know how it's come about. The wells are there. About one-fifth of the water of Ann Arbor comes from the Ann Arbor Airport. That's how they own the big pumping wells.
I live off Sile Church Road.
What's that?
I live off Sile Church Road.
I know. I lived right near you. Remember on Waltham?
That's right. That's right. You lived on Waltham. But I hear a helicopter go by me a lot in the evening, late nights.
If you went out there, you would know. It's the emergency helicopters, the university's choppers. These are million-dollar choppers that are going out, in most cases, to go to some auto accident to pick up the patient and fly them to the hospital. They're flying night and day. These pilots are on duty with these university choppers. Survival flight.
Did you ever fly a helicopter?
No, I never had the urge. I never had the opportunity or the want to put the expense of flying a helicopter. I have some friends that fly, and I flew in them, but never something I just never got around to doing. But the airport is very advanced in that stage. Also, it's one of the biggest schools around for training pilots on helicopter training. Any of your audience want training as a helicopter pilot from a fixed-wing aircraft, we can go out to the airport at Bijan Aviation, and he gives lessons in the helicopters.
Well, locally, if some young man wants to learn to fly, can he learn to fly at the Ann Arbor Airport?
What's that, Ted?
Locally, if some young man wants to fly, wants to learn to fly.
Yes, so one of the places, the Aviation Center, that's where they train. Also, the Michigan Flyers is a club. And by the way, Ann Arbor Flyers, the one that 10 of us started back in 1940, is still going today. One of the oldest flying clubs in the United States. Some of your audience probably belong to that. But 10 of us started that back in 1940.
Listen, they're cutting us off here. But I do want to remind you about MDN, friends, at Briarwood, at MDN at the University of Michigan Football Stadium, MDN downtown Ann Arbor, MDN, 29 South University, MDN, sportswear, memorabilia. For the Michigan fan, there's no better place than a gift item from MDN. Thanks to Doug Horning and David Hearn. Paul Lahr has been our guest. I want to thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Ted. You do a good job of interviewing to keep me relaxed. I hope I presented
reminiscing through the years, 63 flying years with Paul Lahr.
Ted Heisel Show. You can hear Ted Heisel every Monday through Friday right here on Radio 16. Views expressed by Ted and his guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the management of WAAM, its staff, or its sponsors. The Ted Heisel Show is an exclusive production of Radio 16, WAAM.